This episode of the Memory Palace is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit Progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DiMeo. Time had changed. Used to be you woke up with the sun, rose to the rooster, got done what you could with the light that God had given you. Every purpose under heaven according to a time kept by the seasons, by the shadows, by your own dark figure cast upon your garden, stretched by the waning of the day. It had been that way since time immemorial, although remembering the time wasn't the issue. It was knowing it in the first place. There was the sundial. The Babylonians came up with that one. Could have been the Egyptians. But either way, it worked okay for a few thousand years, as long as it wasn't cloudy or nighttime. Then a French monk came up with the hourglass, with which people mostly did monk things. Do this prayer until the sand runs out. Flip it. Do another prayer. That was about 1400 years ago. And then there were many inventors in many countries trying their hands at clockmaking. There were water clocks. There were clocks based upon the measurement of burning candles. There were mechanical clocks, even those marvelous ones in European cities, where some metal lion in a crown comes out to hit a bell with a mallet to mark high noon or whatnot. And these were impressive feats of engineering that had royal houses fighting to retain the services of renowned clockmakers, had the clockmakers themselves fighting over clockmaking methodologies, over whether time would be set according to the movement of the heavens, or by the shadow cast when the sun strikes a local landmark. They'd debate in philosophical societies or other august bodies about how and when and whether a clock should be adjusted according to the time of year or the rotation of the earth. But to what end? Your ancestor, toiling in a quarry, tilling someone else's field, pulling up a net from the gray-green sea, didn't care a whit about a clock tower talking away another hour in some distant capital. They cared about the light. How much was left? How much work could be done before the day faded away? Even in the cities, even in America, where upon the mantles above the hearths of its fancier homes one might, during the early years of the 19th century, find a clock chiming according to some clicking gear or swinging pendulum. And so, too, one might find a grand one in some prominent building in the center of some particularly ambitious town. But these clocks were like beginning piano students, at best. However earnest, however clever, or dedicated to the task, they could only keep time so well. Time, then, was a vague notion. And I don't mean that in a what-is-time-anyway man sort of way. I mean it literally. You would tell a friend that you would meet up after dinner, and one of you would probably wind up waiting around, and that was just the way things worked. The festival, the play, the puppet show, the working session of the Constitutional Convention would begin when people showed up. The wagon would leave Boston bound for Worcester when the horses were fed. It would get there when it got there. But then they invented time. And I say they because they felt like a they. The various inventors who had solved the problems, mechanical and theoretical, that eventually made clocks more reliable and more ubiquitous. So before long, and now they knew how long, they could tell you how long you had worked, how much you still owed at the end of the day. They could tell you that the meeting, or lunch, or church starts promptly at 1, could have you running out the door, lamenting what you'd neglected to get done that morning, dreading what was waiting for you when you returned. They could tell you you were late. They took this thing, this abstraction, this agreement between people, and turned it over to a machine. And eventually, through the middle of the 19th century, time, which had been this thing of nature and its rhythms, of the world spinning on its axis at its angle, of the light of a distant star striking it just so, of people bringing in the harvest in its diminishing radiance before the cold set in, and then turning to the work of winter. Natural time was supplanted by clock time, by the movements of some whirring, spinning thing in a box that would tick and tick and tick on and on until your time was up. With clock time came shifts, came punching in and punching out, came new ways to regulate breaks and meals, to calculate how many lockets you had made during the precisely counted hours you spent on that same stool, at that same table, to compare it to the man beside you, to figure out how to get more lockets and more profits. Factory owners could make their clocks run slow on purpose. They could keep people at their looms longer, could cheat them of their time. And as they were inventing time, others were inventing trains. So they created railroad time to make sure commerce ran effectively, to make sure shipments were made efficiently. And they were also inventing light. And they created more hours, which they filled with your work, created more ways to watch out for idle hands, for untapped profit potential, new ways to make workers work like clockwork. But about that light, and about that time, New Yorkers crowded onto a Jersey Brown train on New Year's Eve, 1879. The rail service had added cars to accommodate extra riders. The conductor checked his watch, called all aboard, and the train pushed out of the station and on into the darkness. The passengers had been drawn out of their homes on that winter evening and away from the warmth of their fireplace and their candlelit dinner parties by word that Thomas Edison, the inventor they had been reading so much about, who had brought the world the phonograph just a couple of years before, would demonstrate in the last moments of the year an unprecedented display of electrified illumination. 70 lamps lit by direct current. An astounding achievement that one simply could not miss the chance to see. And so they crowded the aisle, leaning across the seats of their luckier neighbors, who sat on the correct side of the train, whose noses were pressed against the cold window, to see the orbs aglow above the snow-covered ground, lighting a path up the hill from the train depot to Edison's laboratory at Menlo Park, and out into the night air beneath lights, their breath catching for a moment, flashing in the amber glow of the bulbs as they walked up to the inventor's office, each window lit, each window a marvel, and saw, and knew right then that they saw, the future, knew that they, that handful of hundreds, there on the edge of 1880, were the first people to ever walk at night in the light, were there amidst the artificial glimmer of the dawn of a new age. And though those lights would change time for them again, would keep them at the office late, would force more hours into their workday, would steal, permanently, what historians tell us are 2 full hours from their sleep, and though Thomas Edison himself would be at work the next morning, and every morning, and now every night, finding new ways to put more into, to wring more out of every precisely timed hour, every perfectly delineated minute, and though they would never rest, trying to ensure that we never could, they, Edison with his electric lights, they with their ticking clocks, had also managed to invent New Year's Eve, when you could step out into the streets late into the night and know that there would be light to guide you, help you steer clear of danger, and find your step and find your way home, even as you lost yourself a bit at the punch bowl. When you could stand in the town square, or on a rooftop, or in the light of a crowded party in an apartment, you're not entirely sure how you all wound up there, and all count down from 10, knowing that all over the city, it was the same 10, and 9, and down till the bells would ring, till the band would sing, till the first fireworks cracked, till you kissed that boy you just met, or that girl you met 20 years before. We will take a cup of kindness yet. This episode of The Memory Palace was written and produced by me, Nate DiMeo, with research assistance from Eliza McGraw. The show gets engineering assistance from Elizabeth Aubert. It is a proud member of Radiotopia, a network of independently owned and operated podcasts from PRX. If you find yourself at the end of this trying year with the inclination to support independent media and the means to do so, you can make a tax-deductible donation to radiotopia.fm/donate. Before I leave you, I want to thank you for spending this time with me, whether this is the first episode you've ever listened to, or whether this is the end of just another of many years. I am wishing you all good health and more comfort in the coming year. And wishing, too, a happy anniversary to my wife, whom I met on New Year's Eve at a party at a friend of a friend's place in Manhattan, 20 New Year's Eves ago. May we all be at parties when the next one comes around.
Radiotopia.